Today is Tuesday, September 5th. We're going to talk about heart anatomy today. All right, so page 35 begins the heart information. The next test covers the heart. The next test, in fact, will cover heart and blood vessels. And so it's a big old cardiovascular test, come test number two. You'll also have the lymphatic system on test number two, but it goes really well with understanding of blood vessels and blood pressure. So instead of having two fairly unrelated topics like we do for test number one, test number two is going to be really one big topic that's just spread over three different chapters. All right, so we're going to be looking at the heart's role in the cardiovascular system. The heart's job in the cardiovascular system is to pump blood. In order to create blood pressure, the heart has to put enough force or push behind that blood to propel it out through your vessels. And then, of course, the job of your blood vessels is simply to transport that blood around to your body's cells and tissues. So we're going to focus for the next few weeks on heart and then blood vessel functions. So in terms of heart structure, we know the heart is located in which cavity? Thoracic, good. We know the heart is situated in a snug little area of your thoracic cavity. It's called the mediastinum or mediastinum. And that little region is situated between your two lungs. In that mediastinum, we also have a piece of the esophagus that travels back behind the heart. We also have a piece of your vagus nerve, which loops through your ligamentum arteriosum area and then goes down further into your abdominopelvic cavity. So that mediastinum, that little snug region here in the center of your chest, is going to house the heart. In terms of heart structure, it has a pointed apex. In what direction is that pointed apex situated?
The left side.
Left side, good. So they say oftentimes it is pointed towards your left hip. There is also a portion of your heart that has a bunch of blood vessels on top. That region is known as the base, and the base is oriented towards your right shoulder. Okay, so in reality, your heart is pretty much dead center in the middle of your chest, in that mediastinum cavity in your chest cavity. And even though it's only situated about a half inch skewed to the left, a lot of people get the sensation that their heart is, in fact, on the left side when it's not. So why do you think somebody would falsely think their heart's on the left side of the body? That's where it pumps, right? Yeah, so that pumping activity, is it oriented towards your apex or toward the base?
The apex.
The apex, yeah. So because it's oriented toward the left hip, we do falsely get a sense that the heart is on that side of the body. Okay. So interesting relationship here between the heart and the lungs. They are very close together. And in order to keep them from rubbing past each other, there is a very thin layer of membrane surrounding the outside of the heart and the lungs. We call those membranes serous membranes. And going way back to Bio-210, what type of tissue makes up those serous membranes? It's epithelial. Yep, epithelial tissue makes them up, and there's a very thin layer of fluid between the two layers, and that fluid is called?
Serous
fluid, good. Okay. So let's talk about that pericardial set of membranes that surrounds the heart on the outside. Let's first talk about the serous membrane construction. This is kind of taking you back to Bio-210 for just a moment. On your worksheet, I am specifically talking about the second bullet point there, the serous pericardium, and I'm specifically focusing on parietal pericardium and visceral pericardium, okay? So the serous pericardium is just a fancy name for the set of slippery, lubricating membranes surrounding the outside of the heart, and these two membranes, the visceral and parietal layer, are going to come together and form a serous pericardium. Okay. So in terms of telling the difference between the visceral and the parietal layer, which one is the innermost one?
Visceral.
Visceral, good. What's a great clue there to keep that straight?
Visceral has the visceral, which means organ.
Organ.
Visceral side.
Yep, good. Visceral side is the organ side, good. So in this picture here, what number is the visceral layer?
Number one.
Number one, good. So where would you find the heart? deep to number one or superficial to it?
Deep to
the number one, yes. So it would be, of course, inside here. Number two is pointing at an outer layer. We call that one the parietal pericardium. And there's actually a big space that they're demonstrating. It's not truly that large, but there is a space between the visceral and the parietal layers. What's found in between that set of layers?
Serous fluid.
Serous fluid, good. And what's the function of that fluid?
To reduce friction.
Reduce friction, good. Lubricate around the heart. And when you go back and look at a picture like this one and you realize how closely associated the heart and lungs are, yeah, you kind of need something to keep those organs from frictioning and rubbing past one another. So it's kind of like, you know, lubricant fluid. It does allow the heart to beat. It allows the lungs to glide and slide past the heart without rubbing those organs past one another. Okay, so let me add one more layer to the mix here. Let's go back up on your worksheet to the fibrous pericardium. The fibrous pericardium is, in fact, an outermost tough layer. So if it is the outermost layer, where would you draw it in relation to the visceral and the parietal serous membranes?
Out in front of the parietal.
Yeah, outside of the parietal. So if we were drawing on here, I would come beyond my parietal pericardium, and I would draw my fibrous on the very outside. Okay? So in reality, that fibrous pericardium is anchored to or adhered to your parietal pericardium. So you ever bought gift wrap in the store that has decorations on both sides? Okay, maybe you've gotten a gift that's got double-sided gift wrap. Okay, so that's how the fibrous and the parietal pericardia work. The outside layer that you're looking at is fibrous, and then when you peel it back, the underside is parietal pericardium. If you've ever bought double-sided gift wrap, you cannot separate those, right? You just deal with whatever side you get. That's the same thing here with fibrous pericardium and the parietal pericardium. They are glued to each other. There is no separating them. One side is fibrous, peel it back, and the other side is parietal pericardium. Now, if we continue going further, what is the next membrane that you encounter deep?
The visceral.
The visceral, good. And I should mention that visceral is so tightly adhered to your heart muscle itself that you can't really remove the visceral without pulling away myocardium as well. So that myocardium is anchored to your visceral serous membrane of the pericardium layer. Okay, so in terms of layering here, the outermost that we encounter is called fibrous. Fibrous is anchored to your parietal membrane. There is your pericardial space. What's in that space? Yeah, there's serous fluid in there. And then you encounter your next layer, which is your
visceral.
Good. And it should be directly anchored to what? Myocardium, right.
So that would be considered your epicardium?
Yes. So that's what makes it really complicated and confusing. Yeah. Okay, so if you were taking a needle and you were piercing into the heart for some reason, the layers you would encounter are, of course, number one, your fibrous, number two, your parietal. You then encounter this serous fluid, and then the third layer you encounter is the visceral layer. Okay, so there are, in fact, three layers on the outside of the heart. It just so happens that two of them are anchored together like double-sided gift wrap. So let's start here with this picture. What is letter B that's anchored directly to the myocardium?
Visceral,
good, that's the visceral pericardium. You might even notice there's a space between letters B and A. It looks like they've peeled back that outer layer. So very specifically, what is letter A? Parietal. Yeah, that's parietal pericardium. Visceral and parietal pericardium are what type of membrane?
Serous membrane,
right. And of course, if you were to lay that letter A back down and cover up the heart with it, you'd now look at the outside, which is made up of
fibrous
pericardium. Good. So I think you can kind of get a sense of the gap of space between letters A and B, and that's where that serous fluid is housed. Okay. So how about questions so far on the visceral, parietal, and fibrous pericardium? So one thing you're going to find in this chapter is that they name things two and three different names, which can be really confusing, like epicardium and visceral pericardium. Well, there's also disorders here. And so this particular disorder has to do with excess fluid between the visceral and parietal pericardia. This disorder is called cardiac tamponade. Its alternate name is heart plug. And an even another name here is pericardial effusion. All three names mean the same thing, that there is excess fluid between your visceral and parietal pericardium. Sure, it could be serous fluid, but it could also be blood. It could also be pus that builds up from an infection. So whatever the case, whatever the underlying issue is here, how do you think your heart beats when it's got an extra layer of fluid squeezing from the outside?
Harder.
Harder and faster, yeah. And why do you think your heart has to beat harder and faster? It's got all that pressure, all that weight of fluid. It's trying to inject adequate blood out to your body. So it may cause the heart to have to beat faster. So that's really an issue for a person who may have had surgery and has, say, blood or pus accumulating around the heart. Heart attacks can also introduce blood seeping from the inside to that outer pericardial membrane. And surgeries can also introduce blood or pus into that area. They even say things like cancer can cause pus to build up in those areas between those two membranes. So nonetheless, however, you know, we look at the underlying cause, we need to reduce the fluid around the heart. So this on the right-hand side shows you a type of syntesis where they're pulling off the fluid. And of course, you would not want to go too far into the heart because then you'd be pulling fluid from inside where it's actually flowing. So it's a very delicate thing to make sure you don't go too deep into the heart muscle tissue. Just stop there where you're pulling between the visceral and parietal pericardium. I'll tell you an easy way to keep this one straight. If you think of that first word up there, cardiac tamponade, what do tampons do? They plug up stuff, right? Okay, and if you've got extra fluid around the outside of the heart, you need that tampon basically to soak up the excess fluid. So if you think about it in those terms, it may be easier to remember what cardiac tamponade is. So there is also something similar to this that can happen to our lungs. Instead of calling it pericardial effusion, what do you think they call this situation when it happens to your lungs? Yeah, pleural effusion, exactly. Okay. So let's turn our attention to talking about the layers or walls of the heart itself. And this time we're going to start with the visceral pericardium, whose alternate name is epicardium. Oh boy. Okay, so the epicardium is also the visceral pericardium. So in terms of layers here, are we on the superficial side of the walls, or are we deep? Where are we? Yeah, so we're, in terms of heart wall itself, we're superficial. And then, of course, the epicardium or visceral pericardium is directly attached to the myocardium. Okay, and then what's inside that? Endocardium, good. All right, so in this picture, you can see the epicardium is just simply that outermost layer of the heart wall. Next, coming in deeper, is myocardium. And then deep to that, inside the heart, is a thin layer of simple squamous epithelial tissue that forms our endocardium. I want to make a point about that endocardium. That endocardium is continuous with the epithelial lining for your blood vessels. What that means is, if you have an infection inside the heart, and it travels to your blood vessels, there goes the infection all the way from your heart to the blood vessels. So by having a continuous membrane here or lining, it means that infections can very easily travel from one point to the next point. Just want to go back and review myocardium for a little bit. I know you guys have seen cardiac muscle tissue in Bio-210. It may have been a while since you thought about all the characteristics of heart muscle tissue. What are some features that are unique to this type of muscle tissue?
Branched.
Intercalated discs. What about some other features?
Strided.
Right, so it's uninucleate, okay? So in this picture, you can see some of those intercalated discs. And the reason they are important is because they serve as gap junctions. What do gap junctions allow to happen?
Fluid passage.
Fluid passage, right. So if you've got ions inside those cells, those ions and the fluids can pass through the gap junctions to the neighboring cell. And if we want our cells to depolarize and contract, there's nothing to slow down that depolarization event going from one cell to the next. How do you think that the branching pattern also helps your heart muscle tissue?
To make it lighter?
What if you want all this tissue in this area to work together? You send a message, and the message splits and runs through branches, and it hits instantly to all those cells. So the branching pattern, in addition to this intercalated disc setup, allows for the heart muscle tissue to work cohesively as a unit. Why is that important for heart muscle tissue?
Because it's pumping out blood.
It's pumping out blood, right? And what if different chambers are contracting at different times and different rates? You got backflow problems. You might have blood sitting there and pooling. And what can happen if blood sits in there and pools? Clotting, yeah. So in order to make sure that blood is ejected at a reasonable rate, we want all those heart chambers to work together as a unit. We do want your atria to contract first and then your ventricles to contract second. So that's really the timing issue that we're looking for here. I do want to mention something that's kind of sad about heart muscle tissue. It doesn't contain stem cells that allow for regeneration. And so if you damage heart muscle tissue, say through heart attack, what happens?
Scar
tissue, exactly, yep. So they're hoping in years to come that they can do something to prevent scar tissue from buildup. In fact, if they can use stem cells in your heart to make the tissue regrow, then parts of your heart that may have been damaged may then be able to contract and pump blood. But for now, you know, heart attack patients who have had, you know, damage to heart muscle tissue, they're looking at scar tissue forming that repair. All right. Some issues at the very bottom of your page. Pericarditis. What specifically is inflamed here?
Pericardium.
And I want to kind of make an issue here about pericarditis. Pericarditis is inflammation. What happens to tissues when they're inflamed? They swell. Okay, and if we're inflaming or swelling those pericardial layers, do they glide and slide past each other?
No, they're going to get stuck.
Yep, so they're going to rub past each other. They're going to be swollen. And so this is not exactly the same thing as cardiac tamponade. Cardiac tamponade may be fluid between the layers, but this particular issue is inflammation of those membranes. So they may, in fact, be rubbing and swollen and not able to lubricate around the heart. Bacterial infections can lead to this, especially if somebody has, say, lung issues like pneumonia. Those issues can travel from the pleura of the lungs over here to the pericardium of the heart and then inflame around those heart layers.
Can it cause it to rupture?
I think it can.
A lot of pain,
yeah.
But yeah, can they repair?
I think they can surgically knit that stuff back. It may just be, since it's a single layer, they probably just have to wait mostly for that tissue to regrow. And because it's epithelial, it should. Yeah. Let's see. Endocarditis is inflammation of the inside of the heart lining. Again, this is probably bacterial. And you'll notice here, this is pus built up on these heart valves. And same thing in this picture. These are heart valves. Notice all that chordae tendony. And right there looks like an ulceration from an infection inside the heart. So things like bacterial infections can set up inside the heart. Of course, this is painful, but it can also cause problems with the distribution of blood from the heart. Okay, just checking to see if you guys have any questions here on this first page. The next page may help you for lab. That's page 36. Got some heart structures there to look at. Okay, so the number four was our thing to remember for hemoglobin. You know, hemoglobin transports four oxygens good. And so let's just keep that number four with us. For the heart, there are four chambers and there are four valves. All right, so let's talk about the top two chambers. These top two chambers are called the atrium. This one on the right-hand side is specifically the right atrium. And of course, over here is the left atrium. And I know I talked about this in class on Thursday of last week, but you just want to be cautious about not putting right atria on a test to put right atrium, since atrium is a single chamber. Notice the myocardium here. Are the atria thick-walled or thin-walled?
Thin-walled.
Yeah, not a lot of thickness to these, not a lot of myocardium here. What does that tell you about the pumping activity of the atrium?
Not much,
yeah. So there's not a great deal of pumping power in the atria. In fact, where do the atria send their blood?
Ventricles.
Yeah, so if you're sending your blood literally next door, you don't need a whole lot of power to push it down into the two ventricles. Hey, gravity will do most of the work for you. So gravity pulls a lot of that blood down into those two ventricles without those atria having to do a whole lot. The two discharging chambers of the heart are the two ventricles. Take a close look. What do you notice about the thickness of the myocardium in these two chambers?
Thinner
on the right side, thicker on the left side. Why the difference there? Yeah, got to have thickness on the left side, right? Pumping out to the whole body. And so the left side of the heart is what we think of as the systemic circuit. It is pumping blood out to the body. Where does the right side send blood?
To the lungs.
To the lungs. Good. Sends it to the lungs. So we're kind of getting a feel right now for how the heart is working. We know those two atria are thin-walled. They only have to send their blood down to the ventricles. Those ventricles, by contrast, pump the blood out. The left ventricle is thicker than the right ventricle because the left ventricle is part of what type of circuit? The left side, yeah. It's what type of circuit? A systemic circuit, yeah. And the right side sends blood where? To the lungs, good. It's part of a pulmonary circuit. Okay. So
what
on your work,
what's that? What do you mean by systemic circuit?
Body. Systemic means body circuit. And so we'll hit that again actually on page 38 in just a few moments. Okay, you guys have a question there in the middle of the page to take a look at. The left side or left ventricle sends oxygenated blood to the entire body via the aorta. And then of course, do you know why the left ventricle is larger? Pumps the blood to the body. That's right. Left ventricle is larger. It pumps blood to the body. So there is a wall dividing both atria and ventricles. The wall is called a septum. There is an interatrial septum, but it's actually pretty hard to see in this picture. You have to use your imagination that there is a wall up underneath your pulmonary trunk and aorta that separates your right atrium from your left atrium. You know, if you take a look in those heart models in lab, you can probably see the fossa ovalis. It's sitting up against that interatrial septum that divides your two atria. And then, of course, the interventricular septum is much easier to see. It divides what? Your two ventricles, good. So it's pretty meaty muscular myocardium down here. That does divide the two ventricles from each other. So you just kind of use your imagination and say, well, if I were to continue this on up, the divider between the atria would kind of be similar. Okay. And then on the outside surface, we know there are sulcuses, which are grooves, and those vessels lay in those grooves on the outside surface of the heart. Let me take you on over to page 37. Let's talk about heart valves there. Okay, so there's four chambers, there's four heart valves. These heart valves are meant to prevent the backflow of blood and to enforce that the blood pressure is maintained so we can continue pushing it to the next place. All right, so what are the names of the valves between the atria and the ventricles? In general, you're right, they're called atrioventricular valves. To be very specific, the one on the right side is also called?
Bicuspid valve.
Good. And the one on the left?
Bicuspid valve.
Or mitral valve, good. And so you probably have heard the trick to try before you buy. Try with an R is on the right side, buy is on the left side. The name for these, of course, comes from the number of flaps or cusps that they have. The tricuspid on the right has how many?
Three.
And the bicuspid on the left?
Two.
Two, good. And the alternate name for bicuspid?
Mitral
valve. So, you know, when I mentioned a few minutes ago that they name things two or three different names in the heart, here we go. The left AV valve is also called the bicuspid valve, is also called the mitral valve. There are three names now that you've got for that left side.
Well, you can use any one of those
names. Any one of those names, sure can. Do you have a name for bicuspid valve? Yeah, mitral valve or left AV valve. And of course, on the right-hand side, you've got two names. You can call it the right AV valve or tricuspid valve. So, choices, right? So let's talk about the structure of those atrioventricular or AV valves. These valves are anchored by heart strings known as?
Chordate
tendinae. Good. And they are attached to tiny muscles in your ventricles known as?
Papillary
muscles. Good. Papal means nipple. I don't know, it's kind of a strange thought to think of these nipple-like structures inside the ventricles. But yeah, you can kind of use your imagination and see a nipple-shaped structure inside each ventricle. Those are the papillary muscles sticking up there and there. So when the heart contracts, the muscle tissue shortens, and the ventricles are going to pull down on those heart strings, slamming your AV valve shut. And with the closure of those AV valves, we cannot backflow blood into the two atria. We are then left with only one exit route, and that is to go up through these semilunar valves to the pulmonary trunk or through the aorta. All right, so in terms of issues, which side of the heart has higher pressure?
The left side.
The left side, okay. So in terms of backflow issues, which side do you think has more problems? The left side, right. So you've probably heard of things like mitral valve prolapse, you know, all sorts of issues on the left side, less so for the right side because there's less pressure problems over there. Let's see, the other two valves are called semilunar valves, and they're kind of like trap doors. They are going to remain closed, and the only time they're forced open is when? Yeah, blood in the ventricles is being forced out through those semilunars. And you can see that there's a aortic semilunar right here, and there's a pulmonary semilunar valve right there. They do guard the base of two large arteries exiting the heart. They're only open when blood forces their way through, and then they slam shut right afterwards. And again, all these valves are closing to prevent the backflow into a previous location. So let's go back and take a look at this picture one more time. Let's think about your mitral valve for just a moment. When it slams shut, we are trying to prevent blood in your left ventricle from spewing backwards into your left atrium. Likewise, when your pulmonary semilunar is closed, that's preventing blood in your pulmonary trunk from sliding backwards into your right ventricle. So when we're thinking about backflow here in these valves, we're kind of thinking to the previous location the blood just came from. All right, so let's talk about these valves for just a moment. For the most part, these valves are not always open or closed, you know, together. They're going to be alternating. So if you've got open semilunar valves, most likely what's going on with your AV valves? They're closed, right? And so that's the way we force blood through the heart. We alternate opening and closing these valves to make sure the heart goes through. I do want to make a point here. There is never, ever a time when all four heart valves are open. Okay? Never, ever a time when all four heart valves are open. You would lose all pressure if you had all four heart valves open. So there's never a time when all four will be open. But there is a time when the heart valves are closed. In fact, there's two times when they're all closed at the same time. So as we go through the cardiac cycle, we'll talk about how this works. But, you know, never ever have them all four open at the same time. But twice during the cycle, we'll find that all four valves are closed. So thinking about these semilunar valves, which one of them do you think suffers the most problems? Yeah, aortic semilunar valve. Why is that? Yeah, has the most pressure. We're pumping blood out to the body. So we see the most heart valve issues on the left side with the mitral valve and with the aortic semilunar valve. That's really where it makes the most difference, right? Because you're dealing with blood being pumped in a systemic circuit all over your entire body. Okie doke. So that takes us about halfway of page 37. How's the stuff sticking so far? So far, so good? Okay. Hey. Anybody got money left outside on the bench? I'll take it downstairs if nobody claims. Okay, thanks. All right. So our next thing about halfway down the page is called coronary circulation. And as the name implies, coronary means circulation to what organ? To the heart. Okay, so we spend so much time talking about how the heart operates as a pump that we sometimes forget, oh yeah, it's an organ, and oh yeah, it needs oxygenated blood because we have to furnish that oxygenated blood to the myocardium. So that's what this is. This is a way for the heart to basically steal a little bit of blood away from the aorta and then pump it out into the myocardium. So in this picture, what vessel carries oxygenated blood away from the heart to the body? Aorta. Good. And so if you want to borrow a little bit of oxygenated blood, why not take it from the aorta? And that's in fact what the heart will do. Branching off the base of the aorta, you'll notice there are several coronary arteries. These coronary arteries borrow a little bit of oxygenated blood. They channel that oxygenated blood to your myocardium. So in this picture, you've got one traveling over here on the left side. You've got one traveling over here on the right side. And then there's also coronary arteries on the back side of the heart. You ever heard of a heart attack called the Widowmaker? Okay, so out of all four chambers, which is probably the most important one for sending blood out to the body? The left ventricle. Okay, so if you interrupt blood supply to your left ventricle, there's your Widowmaker. And so this left anterior descending artery that comes over here is sometimes called the LVAD, left ventricle ascending or anterior descending artery. That's the one that sends blood to the left ventricle and is most important for making sure that you can send oxygenated blood out to the body. So that's probably our most critical of our coronary arteries. So arteries, we know, carry oxygenated blood. We know that we have to branch them into arterioles and capillaries where the gas exchange occurs. And then we start picking up blood in little tiny veins called venules. These venules join with larger veins, and for most of us, the veins join on the back side of the heart in this vessel right here called the coronary sinus. And I say most of us because we're all made a little different, and you may find, say, a couple people out of 100 that don't drain this way. So most of us have a drainage pattern into the coronary sinus. I do want to emphasize the coronary sinus is just a big name, a big fancy name for a vein, right? It's not anything different. It's just a vein. And into what chamber does that coronary sinus now carry deoxygenated blood?
To the right atrium.
To the right atrium. Good. So from there, we're back to the starting point, and we can just let the blood go back through and get reoxygenated, and then we'll go back and steal a little bit away for our myocardium. Okay, so let me reemphasize here, the coronary arteries borrow blood by tapping into the aorta. Okay, so they get their blood by tapping into the aorta. The drainage pattern for most of us involves taking that deoxygenated blood back to a vein on the back side known as what?
Coronary sinus.
Coronary sinus, good. And into what chamber will it dump deoxygenated blood?
The right atrium.
The right atrium, good. That is a commonly missed set of questions on previous tests. The coronary arteries get blood from the aorta. That's something you may want to mark and just make sure you pay attention to that. And blood for most of us drains back into that coronary sinus. That's another commonly missed question. If you've heard of open heart surgery, it also goes by a bunch of other names, including this one here called CABG, C-A-B-G, technically stands for coronary artery bypass grafting. And in this case, we may borrow one of your vessels. We don't intend to return it. We may borrow it permanently to bypass a clogged up or damaged area. So what are some of the vessels they'll typically harvest from a person that they plan to do this surgery for?
Where do they get the veins
from? From the leg, yeah. They'll take a vein from the leg. In some cases, they'll take one out of the arm. And they've even taken mammary veins before to make these bypass grafts. What is the advantage of using your own vessels? Right. Very little chance of rejection, right? So most likely your body's going to recognize those vessels and say, ah, that looks like me, no chance to fight that off as you would somebody else's. Now, if they are harvesting veins and using them to do bypass, what is the disadvantage here? You're taking a vein from some other part of the body. Now, that part of the body has to learn how to reroute blood back to the heart. And even though we haven't yet talked about it, but you may be using a vein to create the job for an artery. And so we're going to learn that arteries operate under high pressure. What kind of pressure do veins have?
Lower pressure,
yeah. So this kind of surgery may last a patient, say, 20, maybe 30 years. And then at that point, the vessels may wear out because we're not using the same type of vessel that was originally there in the first place. So there can be as many as a 9-way bypass. You can have as few as a 1-way bypass. The number indicates what? How many vessels are bypassed, right? So if you happen to have a blockage in a vessel or perhaps damage done to that muscle tissue and the vessel's not doing its job, use a new bypass to graft over, like you can see here, and that creates a new connection of blood flow. Why tap into the aorta? That's got the oxygenated blood. And so all we're doing is creating new pathways over blocked areas. So that way that muscle tissue can continue to thrive and live. And of course, that's the goal here. We want to make sure that muscle tissue is able to operate. All right, so that should do it for page 37. How are you doing so far? Got any questions on anything? Okay, let me know. All right, so page 38 is blood flow through the heart, and I know you guys have been doing this in lab. I just want to mention that there are two pathways here. There is a systemic circuit and there is a pulmonary circuit. Okay, so that systemic circuit is a blood flow pathway that takes blood to and from your body. And where does the pulmonary circuit take blood? To the lungs, right. So what you've got written on page 38 actually covers both systemic and pulmonary circuits. Let's kind of think specifically here. What vessel takes blood from the heart to the body?
The aorta.
Aorta, good. And the aorta gets blood from which chamber?
The left ventricle.
So technically, left ventricle and aorta lead you to that systemic pathway. Okay, so technically left ventricle and aorta take you on a systemic pathway. So what blood vessel takes you to the lungs?
Pulmonary arteries,
good. And the pulmonary arteries branch off of our pulmonary
trunk.
And the pulmonary trunk gets blood from which chamber?
Right ventricle.
Good. So the right ventricle and the pulmonary arteries are part of that pulmonary circuit. Okay, pulmonary arteries and right ventricle are part of that pulmonary circuit. Because blood flow is just a pathway that has no start or no end point, you're going to want to feel comfortable with the blood flow pattern for our second test, starting and ending anywhere. I've just given you a flow pathway that begins with your SVC, IVC, and coronary sinus, happens to end at the very same place, but technically you can pick any point as your starting point and make it your same ending point. So there's about 20 or so structures here. I know you guys are learning this for lab. I wouldn't worry with this until you get at least your first lecture test in here out of the way and over with. But you know, as you are studying for lab, think about keeping this in your brain, because this is going to be a guaranteed essay question on our second lecture test in here. Okay, so just to go through the flow pathway the way it's written in your course pack, we can start by entering into the right atrium. We receive blood from three places that carry deoxygenated blood. We have blood coming in from the head and arms through the SVC or superior vena cava. What brings blood up from below the heart?
Inferior vena cava.
And what brings blood flow from coronary circulation into the heart?
Coronary sinus, right.
So those three veins dump deoxygenated blood back into the right atrium. From there, we travel through a valve here known as
the tricuspid valve,
good. We're then in the right ventricle. When that ventricle contracts, notice how it makes this tricuspid valve slam shut, and we force open what next valve?
The
pulmonary semilunar valve. And then you're up through a big vessel known as
pulmonary trunk.
It splits into pulmonary
arteries.
Good, go out to the lungs. So we go to pulmonary arterioles, pulmonary capillaries. What happens at the lungs to that blood?
Oxygenated,
good. Come back through pulmonary venules and pulmonary
veins.
And they, of course, are going to dump you in what chamber? Good. Pass through what valve? Good, bicuspid or mitral or left AV, right? Either one of those. And then finally down into the left ventricle. Where's next?
Aorta.
Good, and then out through the?
Aorta,
good. And then from that point, we're out for what type of circuit?
Systemic circuit,
good. And then we'll learn, of course, that arteries branch into arterioles, branch into capillaries. Capillaries do exchange for us, and then we head back through venules and veins. And then you're back where you started with SVC, IVC, or coronary sinus. Okay, so how are you feeling with that blood flow pattern? Getting there? I know some of you got lab tests today, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so hopefully you're feeling pretty good about that blood flow. All right, so page 39 is next. Anything I can pause and re-explain for you before we go there? Sure. I'll certainly take that in here. Yeah, absolutely. Any recognizable abbreviation I'll take.
And then for the right atrium, so the superior, the anterior vena cava, and the coronary sinus all come in at the same time?
Technically, yeah. Mm-hmm. And they're low pressure drainage, so they're going to be dripping blood back in pretty much all the time.
Okay.
Okay, just get you a little bit onto page 39, and we probably talk a little bit about EKGs today. So the heart is kind of a wicked organ. It does its own thing. It can beat without external control of the nervous system. You know, where have you heard that before? Pretty much nowhere, right? So all of our organs typically operate under the control of some part of our nervous system. Not the heart. The heart says, I do my own thing, I set my own pace, I do it at my speed, and you ain't telling me what to do, right? Heart says, this is my pace that I set. What we're talking about is a system built into the heart muscle tissue called the intrinsic conduction system. That is fancy language that says, this is built-in nervous tissue that sets your heart rate. What is that heart rate? Yeah. 75 beats per minute, right? So by itself, the heart says, this is my pace. I set the pace at 75 beats per minute. The range, by the way, and you got a couple more blanks there. The range is what to what?
60 to 100,
yeah. So 40 to 60 would be if you didn't have control, you know, but 60 to 100 is the acceptable range. By the way, 60 to 100 is what the textbook says. The American Heart Association also says 60 to 100. And I know if you know anything about heart rate, 60 is pretty low and 100 is pretty fast, but I know for certain people, those are acceptable ranges. You may be on medication that makes one of those preferable over the other, but nonetheless, the range there is 60 to 100. So there is nervous tissue built into your myocardium. This nervous tissue is what sets the pace of the heart rate. Let me emphasize, this is not your brain setting the pace, okay? This is not anything setting the pace except for your heart saying, hey, I'm in control here, I'm so important, I get to do my own thing. And so it sets the pace at 75 beats per minute. What specifically is setting the pace is something called the sinoatrial node, or SA node. In plain English, we know it as what? Pacemaker, yeah. So if you are the fastest node of nervous tissue, you get to set the pace. And so 75 beats per minute for most of us is what that pacemaker sets as the pace. As people get older, there may be other pieces of nervous tissue that say, you know, I've been taking a back seat your whole life and I want to be the winner. I want to be the one that sets the pace. And so sometimes in life, people have another piece of nervous tissue that steps up and says, I'm going to set the pace and I want to set the pace at 110 beats per minute. So, you know, we may have to burn off those pieces of tissue and say, nope, you're not the winner this time. That pacemaker has to be the sinoatrial node. And sometimes we give people a pacemaker to make sure that the heart rate stays around 75 beats per minute. If your sinoatrial node fails to be the pacemaker, who's the number two? Who's the runner-up?
The atrioventricular
node. Yeah, atrioventricular node, or AV node for short. Hey, based on its name, do you know where it's located?
Between the atrium and the ventricle.
Yeah, between the atrium and the ventricle. And if you let it be the winner in control, its pace is what? 40 to 60. Is that in your normal range? No, that is too slow to distribute blood out to the body. So if the AV node happens to be the one who's setting the pace, then we're not distributing or perfusing those tissues with adequate oxygen. I'd like to introduce the details of the intrinsic conduction system first, and then we'll consider what the autonomic nervous system can do. Back in Bio 210, you probably learned about the autonomic nervous system controlling involuntary events, and so heart rate is one of those things that we can override if need be. For instance, everybody in here is seated. If I had you cop up as fast as you can, your body is then having to work against gravity to get blood to go to your brain. I'm sure that some of you would feel a little blackout, uneasy, you know, with your blood not getting to your brain fast enough. And so your sympathetic nervous system in that point may kick in to speed up the heart rate so we can get blood to your brain. So only in cases where we need to either increase or decrease heart rate will that autonomic nervous system override your intrinsic conduction system. But, you know, if you're just sitting at your desk and you're not exercising, you're not nervous perhaps, you're just sitting here, then most likely your intrinsic conduction system is doing what it needs to maintain a heart rate of around 75 beats per minute. Any questions so far? Okay. So where is the pacemaker?
Right atrium,
good. And what's the fancy name for your pacemaker? Yep, sinoatrial node, or SA node for short. And because it's the pacemaker, what is the job? Sets the heart rate, right? At around how many beats per minute?
About
75, but you're right, anywhere between 60 to 100 at rest for an adult is considered to be an acceptable normal range. So when the SA node fires off a nerve impulse, that nerve impulse travels through neural connections to your right atrium and your left atrium. Here are those neural connections. And those neurons are going to release acetylcholine. Well, this sounds like a blast from the past, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. When we release acetylcholine onto myocardial muscle tissue, what do the atria do?
Contract.
Good. And they contract, not with a very strong contraction, but nonetheless, where do they push their blood?
To the ventricles.
To the ventricles, right. So they push it down to the ventricles. In order to do that, are your AV valves currently open or closed? They got to be open, right? So if you're forcing blood down to the ventricles, those two AV valves have to be open. Right now, there's going to be a pause. And what we're waiting for is to let that blood pump down to the ventricles and fill the ventricles up. If we send a message too quickly to your ventricles, they will contract and they'll eject blood, but maybe not enough to get out to your body. So this pause occurs after the AV node fires, or sorry, SA node fires and sends messages to your two atria. Now, about this time, the AV node is the second one to get the message. The AV node sits at the base of your atria and ventricle, that connection right there between the two, and it now fires off a nerve impulse. The nerve impulse ultimately tells your ventricles to contract. Let's take the pathway. Okay, so from AV node, we travel through the bundle of His. We split into bundle branches, a left and a right one, and then we travel the walls of your ventricles and terminate with something called Purkinje fibers. When they release acetylcholine, what do your ventricles now do?
Contract.
They now contract, good. And your right ventricle sends blood up through which valve?
The pulmonary
semilunar valve. And your left ventricle sends blood up through the?
Aortic
semilunar valve, right. And we have to have enough blood to go to the lungs for oxygenation and out to the body with all this oxygenated blood. Okay, so we're looking at making sure we pause there to let those ventricles fill with adequate amounts of blood. from the top, the pacemaker is your SA node at the top of your right atrium. It sets the pace by firing approximately how many times per minute? 75, good. When it fires a nerve impulse, what two chambers receive acetylcholine? Right and left atrium, good. In response to receiving acetylcholine, those two chambers will
contract.
So they pump blood down through open AV valves into the ventricles. Good. Now that we've got blood into the ventricles, you know, we've paused long enough, we can now let the message arrive at your AV node or atrioventricular node. It sits down here near the base of your right atrium, close to your interventricular septum. When that AV node fires an impulse, the next place to get the message is the bundle of His. We sometimes call this a junction. From there, where do we go? Bundle branches, and then Purkinje fibers, right? When the Purkinje fibers release acetylcholine, now what chambers contract?
Ventricles,
good. So what we want to ensure here is that your atria have an opportunity to contract first, and then the ventricles contract second. We want those two atria to contract more or less together as a unit, and we want those ventricles to contract more or less together as a unit as well. The timing may be split second off, you know, in terms of which one fires first in terms of the ventricles, but for the most part, we're looking them to contract together as a unit to eject blood. So if 75 beats per minute is what we consider our average heart rate for an adult at rest, this works out to a cardiac cycle of about 0.8 seconds. Okay, so a typical cardiac cycle that we're going to look at for an EKG is about 0.8 seconds. If there's any problem with the rate, up near the top of your page, we have two conditions. One is called tachycardia. The other one's bradycardia. Which one of these is a fast heart rate? Good. Faster than how many beats per minute? 100. Right, so tachycardia is technically faster than 100 beats per minute. How about bradycardia? Good, slower, under 60 beats per minute. So let's take those two issues. Okay, so if you've got, say, a condition of tachycardia, your heart rate may be 120 beats per minute, 150 beats per minute. Okay, it's not perhaps exercise induced, it just may be some condition that's made your heart rate go faster than its normal setting. Which system here, sympathetic or parasympathetic, do we need to slow down that heart rate?
Parasympathetic,
good. And the parasympathetic uses the vagus nerve. That's cranial nerve what? 10, yeah. And it releases a neurotransmitter to slow your heart rate, known as your old buddy from 210, acetylcholine. Yeah. So interesting here, just kind of as a side note, your parasympathetic nervous system is the dominant system for your heart rate. It wants to ensure a slower pace. Okay? So it's not that your sympathetic was trying to make you go faster all the time. Is that your parasympathetic is trying to maintain a slower heart rate. For people who are well, you know, exercised athletes, what is a typical heart rate for somebody who's like an Olympic athlete? 30s for a heart rate or 40s? Yeah. So technically, if you come upon an Olympic athlete who has a heart rate, say, of 35 beats per minute, you think, oh my gosh, how are you alive, right? And so, what does that tell you about their heart muscle tissue?
Strong.
Yeah, really strong, really efficient heart. It may, in fact, hypertrophy or enlarge. But, you know, for someone else who's got 35 beats per minute, pass out, right? You think, boy, you know, get them a chair, let them sit down. But yeah, for somebody who's got a very well-exercised heart, that 35, 45 beats per minute may in fact be normal.
So would that be dangerous?
For them, probably not. For the average Joe who does not have a well-exercised heart, yeah, that probably is dangerous. Because we're probably not pumping out enough oxygen to get it to those cells and tissues.
If they just start running out, would it just like go back to normal?
Most likely, yeah. Their heart will probably lose mass over time and they'll become like the rest of us. Yeah.
So it's not necessarily bad to have a hypo.
If you're exercise induced,
right.
Yeah, then it's not necessarily a bad thing. If it's disease induced hypertrophy,
right.
Yeah, there's the problem. Let's take the other issue there. If you've got bradycardia, what is your heart rate?
Below 60.
Below 60. And for somebody who's not, say, that well-exercised Olympian, then this person may not be distributing enough oxygen out to their cells and tissues. In that case, the sympathetic nervous system says, ooh, we're not getting oxygen out into circulation. Let's increase the heart rate using which neurotransmitters? And norepinephrine, right? Epinephrine and norepinephrine. So in the case where you need to increase heart rate, then the sympathetic nervous system kicks on. In fact, when all of you stand up here to leave today, take a moment to think about the fact that you're now working against gravity by standing up. And in order to prevent you from passing out and blacking out from not having enough oxygen to your brain, your sympathetic nervous system will speed up your heart rate. It will squeeze your vessels. And as long as you're walking wherever you're going, your sympathetic nervous system is going to dominate. What is that going to help you do?
Pay attention or be more aware, maintain heart rate.
Yeah, maintain pulse, maintain heart rate, maintain blood pressure, keep you alert, keep you from passing out. So when we're exercising, we know that sympathetic nervous system is the one that's going to dominate for us. Okay. So I think that hits the blanks on that page for you. I was going to start EKG today, but I think I don't want to get you too far ahead into the next bit of content. So why don't we save EKG, which is on page 40. We'll do that in here come Thursday. Do bring your test questions Thursday. We'll be happy to go back and review whatever you need to hear. Good luck on your lab test this week.